in a nobler, sweeter song, sing his power to save. We enjoyed being able to gather around Mary Vesey and her family yesterday, Tom's memorial, and I can't help but think of him as we sing that today. It's a blessed hope, isn't it? It's a blessed hope. We're week two here in Proverbs, and jumping into the text this morning, verses 1 through 7. So last week, we considered Solomon, but the first line of the book is that it's the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, and he was endowed with this great wisdom from God himself. He experienced a kingdom of peace, and Solomon executed justice and equity throughout most of his reign. He built the temple of Almighty God, whose presence dwelt with his people in Jerusalem. The nations of the world flocked to Solomon to hear him teach about righteousness and wisdom. Yet, as we saw last week, Solomon ultimately failed in walking with God. He failed to walk in the divine precepts that he so skillfully taught and that we have preserved. So this son of Adam, son of David, failed to fulfill all righteousness. And so, last week, we saw humanity's need, desperate need, for divine grace. Solomon is not the solution. Even wisdom standing on its own is not the solution. Even those who have mastery of Proverbs, and those who have mastery of how the world works and how to walk in righteousness are ultimately going to be unable to stand before the holy God with confidence. Not by themselves. No one of us is wise or righteous enough. So we need grace, the lavish, the unending, and generous grace of God. This morning, we look at verses 1 through 7. This is the prologue of the book. It functions as an introduction. The first section really begins in chapter 1, verse 8. We'll look at this in more detail as we go. I'll probably say that several times throughout the morning, so forgive that. But these first 9 chapters are one distinct section, and they're made up with a little bit longer form lectures from father to son. As you read through them, you'll see, my son this, my son that. And that really is chapters 1 through 9, longer lessons from dad to son. You can see in verse 8, the first one of those. My son, hear the instruction of your father, don't forsake the law of your mother. So 1 through 7 is that which precedes the first lecture. Some have argued it's just an introduction to chapters 1 through 9 because there's a big break after that. I think it's an introduction probably to the whole book to teach us a lot of the key words of the book. They're all crammed in here, not all of them, but most of them are crammed in here. So we won't have a full comprehension of all of them this morning, I don't think, but we'll introduce some of the more significant or common ones. And then as we go through the book, we'll just trust that the God will continue to teach us more about these keywords. We see that it's about Proverbs. It's about wisdom. There's teachers and there are students. And he lists the purposes of the book in verses 2, 3, 4, and 6. And then you have at the end, verse 7, which is really the motto or the theme of the entire book is chapter 1. Verse 7, that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Or as he says it in chapter 9, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So because of the significance of that phrase, we're going to take an entire week next week and look at that, what the fear of the Lord is and how it functions in the book. It's really too significant, I think, to be able to cover everything we need to cover this morning. So this is an introduction. And again, as soon as you set foot into the book, you see the author. And then you see Proverbs, which is the title of the book as well as the contents of the book. So what is a proverb is an important question. The Hebrew word mashal, and the idea of a proverb in a general sense, in sort of a zoomed out sense, is this is a statement that carries weight within a community. It's a significant, sort of, it has gravity to it, and glory to it in that sense, that it bears repeating, and it is repeated. Proverbs are repeated often, and they mean something to a particular group of people. Now, what that or who that community is, what it's made up of, or how it originated, could be all sorts of different kinds of things. So step out perhaps from Proverbs for a moment and think about the concept of a proverb. There could be proverbs that revolve around language, like an English proverb. It could revolve around cultures or religion or families, politics and government or vocation. There's all different kinds of proverbs and statements that sort of operate within different circles of our lives. It's like English proverbs, we would probably know many of them. Things like better late than never, or birds of a feather flock together. Some of them, perhaps, if you're ESL, they're like, some of those I had to spend a while figuring out, or some of them I still have no idea what you guys are talking about when you say that. But perhaps a linguistic proverb carries weight to English speakers. Maybe it's a cultural proverb, to be very dramatic about, like, here's a Western proverb, not even one that probably many Western people, an old Western proverb, something like, speak your mind, but ride a fast horse. It's like you maybe something that was said in the Wild West. Religious proverbs, things that might make sense from certain religious perspectives. Let's blend our culture here, the main religion here. Something about like the significance of seagulls. Like if we were to say that, you know, that we're having our harvest, but there's a lot of grasshoppers around or locusts around and they're eating our crops. And you might say something like, don't worry, the seagulls will save us. And if you don't know what that's about, you don't know what that's about. But if you do, then you do. It kind of carries weight within a particular community. People have perhaps certain knowledge. Every family has their own proverbs. Sometimes you just call them inside jokes. Sometimes they're the things that your mom and dad repeat to you ad nauseum. Like, these are proverbs of the family. I have a few of them. My mom would always say, tape them up and send them in for the second half. It's a proverb. It's true. Something that carries weight in the Acree family. My dad would say, as his dad told him, be your own man. Don't be moved by everyone about you, but stand on conscience and the word of God. Okay, so these things have weight in my family. Politics, there's all sorts of political proverbs, or caricatures perhaps, things that might carry weight to an American or a Republican or a Democrat. Different phrases, don't tread on me, there's sort of a proverb that would carry weight within a particular community. Or vocation, right? Everybody would have their own illustrations of those. The things that when you get together with people who do the same job you do, you know what they're going to say already because everybody already says it. It's just the proverb in the community. So the concept is that it's significant. It sort of lands with this thud. It's consistently repeated. It's brought up again and again, not in every moment, but at the right moment. And once you kind of get the hang of it, you can predict the moments. You see them coming. You're like, here comes that proverb. I know it's incoming. So it has weight and value because it speaks a particular truth. And there's the gravity. It's true. You could say every proverb is true. So, as we consider the book that has that name, we would do well to ask the question, what community is Solomon talking about? Who do these proverbs have weight with? What community? So, simply, we'd say, those who fear Yahweh. These are truths within the community of faith, the truths of those who walk with God. That doesn't mean they're not true outside of that community. It means that they have weight for those in the community. Other people might think them light and passing while they're not. So, quite simply, the group is those who fear God. I'm going to pause for a moment and consider a few presuppositions of Solomon as he writes the book, as he writes these proverbs. These are not things that he specifically addresses throughout the book. They're things that he assumes and things that we should assume too as we walk into this book. This is a list from a wonderful book by Daniel Estes named Hear My Son, called Hear My Son. I recommend it. I'll probably talk about it more explicitly in the days to come, but These are a few presuppositions from Solomon's worldview. And the first is a presupposition about creation, that Yahweh is the universal creator. Okay, that all of these relate to why Proverbs have weight in the community of those who fear God. If that's not true, if Yahweh is not universal creator, then these things ought not have the weight they do. So many religions and cultures and sages and wise people from history all have things to say, but they're largely about their local deities. Keyword being local, right? They're not universal. And then we would also argue that they're not truly deities, but they're within that little context, their particular little domain. And Solomon says, no, no, it's not just a God or your God and their gods. This is the one God. This is Yahweh. This is the one who made us. And so he's the cosmic creator. And that truth compels the common ethical system that Solomon embraces. Makes sense? If one God made it all, then it would follow that his ethics apply to all. Good, evil, right, wrong, now we're sounding a little more like Solomon. That's because that applies to all humanity because God is the creator of all humanity. So it dispels the myth of randomness, and there's meaning found in relationship with that one. Okay, so there's a creation presupposition. Then there's an order presupposition. It follows creation. That is that Yahweh is sovereignly controlling the world. So he didn't make it and set it on its course and leave it be. He's intimately involved with every aspect of it. So his control continues beyond the moments of creation. There's no erratic or accidental forces at play, but God maintains and directs, controls the creation that he established. That's the only reason Solomon can say many of the things that he says. His governance extends from his righteousness. So his character is righteous and good, but for when he acts and what he orders and how he designed is intended to flow with righteousness and goodness. That's why life is produced down that path. Okay? Then there's also, because he's creator and sovereign, there's a measure of consistency and predictability to the fact that he rules. Again, you see, that's kind of what Proverbs is about too. Some of the things that we see consistently, that's why it's a proverb, is because it's observable and predictable, reliable. Okay, so he's the creator, he's the sovereign. Then there's a presupposition about rationality. And that is that Yahweh's world is knowable and mysterious. And these two sit next to each other always in wisdom literature. There's something that we know, and there's something that we don't know. This is why when God speaks, we would trust in him, because to be in a position of people who know some things but don't know all things, the question would follow, can you know anything absolutely? Can people who don't know everything know anything absolutely? And the answer is no, because there always might be something you don't know that would change your perspective of what you think you know. It's a little bit twisty, but it's there. Then God, the one who knows all things, says something. And when he says something, there's gravity to it. It weighs something. It's valuable. It's trustworthy because there's nothing he's unaware of. Because he knows comprehensively, he knows absolutely. One of the reasons knowledge from God is so meaningful. Okay? So that leads us then to next week, to Proverbs 1:7. Then in the mystery that we have, what should we do? We should fear the Lord. That's what we should do. We should walk humbly before our God. We should acknowledge that he knows everything. We know some things, and there's a sense of fear. We'll talk about that more next week. Okay, so there's the fear of God. Those are some of the presuppositions that really feed into Proverbs. As we remember Solomon's thinking these things, they're assumed within the covenant community. He speaks out of them. Then we'll have a better understanding of where he's going and what he's grounding some of these weighty statements in, okay? So, continuing on the idea of mashal, these proverbs are not always but often poetic. Now, we see that in the book quite a bit. A lot of them are often short, brief, kind of pithy statements that just roll off the tongue. That happens in a lot of languages and cultures. We see that especially in the second half of the book, second two-thirds of the book, starting in chapter 10. Chapters 1 through 9 is not like that very much. It's a little more long-form stories, lessons, sit down and listen to me, son, rather than just that one-off that your grandpa has to say. But a lot of them are short and poetic, known for, yes, brevity and poetry, but they don't have to be. And then often, the most common feature of those brief poetic statements is a contrast. It could be an opposites, the wise and the fool, and there's a contrasting statement that illustrates the truth. Or perhaps it's a contrast between two good things and you see a distinction between them. Perhaps it's a contrast between good and then better, like this one's nice, but this one's nicer. All sorts of things, all sorts of different kinds of contrast. But keep in mind as you read Proverbs, there's likely going to be a point of contrast that's significant in many of the things that Solomon's saying. Then another feature of mashal and things like mashal is that they're thought-provoking. You look down in verse 6, and you'll see that really blossom. It says, to understand a proverb, there's mashal again, and an enigma, the words of the wise and their riddles. There's all of these different words that are kind of describing similar types of things. The mashal, the proverb, the parable, that type of teaching prompts thought. And so a lot of education in the West particularly can tend toward making things as reduced and simple and clear and digestible as possible. That's good. There's benefits to that. You're not prompting confusion. You're not trying to prompt confusion. You're trying to prompt clarity, which is great. But there's also something very beneficial, and Proverbs leans into this, something very beneficial about not saying everything with extreme clarity. Now, it doesn't mean, then, as our world would say, so like, it's better to always ask questions than to have answers, because Solomon has the answer. He's not just letting the student kind of figure it out because he's not so sure either, so let's just do it together. But he is leading the son. He's teaching him by just sort of keeping it an effort and an energy of the son's mind and heart away. He doesn't want to put everything into a smoothie and blend it up and say, here, drink this. It goes down really easy. It's just straight sugar. No, he says, here's the banana and the blueberries and the whatever else you want to put in your smoothie. He says, eat them. It's better for you, for your body to work on digesting it rather than to just digest it outside and pour it into yourself. That makes sense? So he's engaging the mind and the heart of the reader, of the student, which means it's hard work. We're supposed to stop and think about it. We're not supposed to just be like, oh yeah, I got it. Keep going. Move on. No. They sit and you're like, hold up, slow down. I need to pause there. And he says, okay, you could pause there. I may see a few more things for you to consider, but you could pause there. And so it engages the mind of the student. The other thing about mashal is that, and wisdom literature in general, more of a genre statement, is that it's largely based on observation. He's seen, he's experienced, he's looked, he's tasted and felt and heard. He's engaged his senses. And that has produced as sage upon sage upon sage has done that process. It's produced something very reliable, something tested, something trustworthy. That is the wisdom corpus. That is the tradition of Yahweh's words. And so now, Grandpa, Dad, he passes it on to educate and to form his son, his children. And the wise one will say, okay, I embrace it. Because it's been tested and proved and tried, and God has said. Rather than saying, okay, thank you, I will go test it. And after I've tested it, after I've reached conclusions, then I will embrace it. So this is atypical in the world. Normally, everyone wants their own experience and their own conclusion before they're in. There's something wise, ironically, about that. You don't just embrace things because they're there. But what is this? That's really the question. This is the inspired tradition of wisdom from God. Therefore, we would do well, even that the youngest among us, the younger you are, that you embrace it, the better off you are on the path. Okay? So another one more trail of thought on Mashal, and then we'll go to the next thing. As we walk into the book, Proverbs is often, I think, misunderstood for what it's intended to do, what Solomon is intending to do, what God is intending to do through the book. So people will ask questions like, are the Proverbs promises? And I think the primary intention of what they're saying is, are the Proverbs reliable? How much can I trust them? Mostly because I've had experiences, I've made observations, and they seem contrary to what that says. How are we supposed to deal with that issue as we walk into Proverbs? What a mashal is again, so it's a true statement that has weight within a community. It means something, and it means something for a reason. To use a variety of illustrations, though, of how we should think about a mashal, it's a piece of the whole. A proverb is a piece of the whole. So it is completely true, but it's not the whole truth. Does that distinction make sense? It is absolutely true. These are the words of God. You can rest in them, rely upon them. They hold. Taking one proverb and saying, here's the whole picture, would be folly. That's not how they're intended to be used. So whether it's X solving for something within an algebraic equation, you say, well, I know this piece, and therefore I'm just going to sit and stare at this piece and not really pay attention to some of the others, and if that doesn't work the way I think it should work, then I'm confused and upset. He says, well, hang on, there's an equation here. A lot of things are working. Perhaps it's like a slice of a loaf of bread. Is it true? Absolutely, it's true. Can you use it? Yeah. Should you digest it? Absolutely. Is it the whole truth? No. Does the middle piece tell you about the ends? No, unfortunately, it doesn't warn you about the ends. You have to know more. You need more pieces. Like someone who's examining an MRI. If you have a lot of these sort of quarter-inch slices of information about somebody, if you only have one of them, you only took one of them, and you said, well, I know everything I need to know. Well, you're not using it rightly. Right? You need to continue looking, continue examining, continue gathering truth. It's all true. It's just not everyone isn't the full truth. A piece of a puzzle, right? For those of you puzzlers, if you have like a down under the ocean puzzle and it's blue, all sorts of blues, and they get deeper and there's dolphins and other fish and all these sorts of things going on. And then you have in the corner this ray of sun coming through and you grab like the top left piece and it's bright yellow. And you handed that one piece to somebody and you said, tell me about this puzzle. They said, well, it looks yellow. And you're like, gotcha, it's blue, right? Because you kind of need more information, okay? You're tracking with the idea. Probably too many illustrations already, but it's a different one for everybody. You all have kind of your own thing, right? A tool in the toolbox, however you want to think about it. So you can see then the danger of a microscope in Proverbs. You need a microscope because we need to know exactly what every one of them means. And if you just sort of get what you think is the gist of it and then go apply it broadly, you have to be very careful. We want both to look in very cautiously, very studiously, very careful about authorial intent. And then we need to look broadly because Proverbs says, incline your ear, hear the words of the wise, apply your heart to my knowledge. There's the intro. Now catch this. For it will be pleasant to you if you keep it within you, if you keep them within you. If two of them are ready on your lips, if all of them are ready on your lips. See the importance of the whole book. Okay, we'll let that sit. That's enough intro on proverb. But hopefully that'll prompt discussion. Feel free to interact as we go. So the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. Purpose number one, to know wisdom. Okay, what's wisdom? Here we are on the second and big question for the morning, is what is the genre of the book? So we have a general idea of a proverb that it's a significant, weighty statement to the community of people who fear God, and we have to have all of them so that we know sort of the right one to use at the right time, because they're not all the right ones to use every time. And so now it's intending to teach us how to know this idea of wisdom. What is wisdom? This is one of the biggest questions that leading into this study I've been wrestling with. And I've always heard growing up, and maybe you have a general idea too, and this is a good and right idea. It's not wrong. It's just not maybe the whole picture, that wisdom is knowledge applied. That's true. Wisdom is the application of knowledge. But there's something significant if you're to use a one-word definition of chacham, or this wisdom. What is it primarily communicating? And it's not primarily communicating application, though that's true. The primary idea, and again, we're zooming out of Proverbs for a moment, the general sense of this word wisdom is skill. Someone who is wise is someone who is skilled. We looked back at Solomon last week, and when he called upon the builders, right, he called King Hiram, and he said, because you guys are the most wise when it comes to the cedars. And then he had the bronze worker come, and he said, because you are an incredibly wise craftsman. There's no one that can do what you're doing. You're absolutely skilled. There's sort of an ease with which it's come. Now, what are they doing? They're applying knowledge. Like they know how to do the thing, and they're doing it. So there's you can see sort of the parallel. It's a good application of wisdom or of knowledge is good. But it's primarily talking about skill, this sort of deft ability to be able to move with ease and smoothness throughout something. So a good follow-up question when somebody says, I'm wise, or they are wise, would be, wise in what? Like if one of us were to say, I am skilled, good for you. I have no idea what you're talking about, right? Skilled in what? What ability are you referring to? And there's all sorts of different abilities, sort of the general craftsman idea. But then we know that that's not what Proverbs is talking about. It's not teaching us how to work with our hands or to bend metal into marvelous shapes. It's not talking about that. So when he's saying wisdom, we need to look for a correlative term in the book. Wise in what? Because wisdom is not a moral idea. Skill is not necessarily a moral idea, but we know this book has a lot to do with morality. So what would clue us into that? There are many correlative terms to wisdom, but I think the primary or most important one as it, if we were to answer the question, wise in what, according to Proverbs, would be wise in righteousness. There's the moral term. Wise in righteousness, skilled in morality, skilled in knowing God, the Creator, right? Presupposition. Skilled in knowing the character of the one who made us and the one who has authority over us and the one who designed everything. Skilled to live in his world in a way that pleases him, in a way that's right, moral, righteous. So that's, in a zoomed out sense, the purpose of the book of Proverbs, is to teach us how to walk in righteousness with ease, like a master craftsman. Not someone who's like, okay, I'll give this a try, and it's sort of rudimentary. We're not talking about the first 100 times you do a project. We're talking about the 1,000th time. You know it so well. You could walk in this world in righteousness with your eyes closed. That's what Proverbs is about. That's what it's teaching us how to do. So, littered throughout the rest of this introduction are a variety of other important keywords. We'll talk briefly about some of them. But you can see the structure from the two blank statements: to know, to receive, to give, to understand. These are not necessarily, in Proverbs, one of the tricky things about all these words and ideas and even the purpose statements here is that everything bleeds together. They're saying distinct things, but they're not so distinct that you're like, well, this one's in this box, and that's the purpose there, and this one's in this box. Like, it's sort of a like big pool on the ground. It's like, well, that, I think the milk started there, and the water was over there, and the oil's there, but at this point, it's all just sort of like a big washy mess. So that kind of happens here. Now, one note on the book and structure as we go throughout. Part of the reason it looks like that, potentially, is because we're dumb. We're talking about Solomon's writing. And it says at the end of Ecclesiastes that he arranged all of these things with great care. There's intention to every movement, every stroke of the brush. We might just not be seeing it because we haven't stared at it for long enough. Because we might not be wise enough. But there certainly is crossover in beauty and design and all of this. So the purpose here is knowing wisdom and instruction. And you see in verse 2, know, wise, instruct. And then you see in verse 7, knowledge, wisdom, instruction. So there's kind of a poetic inclusio here at the beginning and end of the prologue. And when we talk about knowledge, we are talking in Proverbs about being conscious of something, being very aware of it, knowing it, having a perception and realization, even an experience. It's pre-experience sometimes. You might be able to know something without having walked through it. You have knowledge, you've listened. So sometimes it would even refer to those kind of like the aha moments of life. You know, when you have your eyes open to something and you're like, oh, I didn't know that before. Now I know. That's a lot of what Proverbs is about. It's like, now I know. It's to, now I know you. It's to help you be able to see things about life before they happen to you. To know the skill of righteousness and how to walk in God's world God's way. And instruction. Instruction is the most common word throughout Proverbs for how the teacher teaches. And it's either verbal or corporal. He has a variety of tools that he may use, but the teacher's always trying to instruct in something. He's trying to pass on from his generation to the next generation, the body of wisdom literature. And you'll see that all throughout. I think the prologue is even probably primarily written to the teacher. You kind of have this emphasis, all right, here's your syllabus. This is the purpose of the class. And he's passing it on to you as parents and ones who are instructing. And then he's going to jump in, my son, right? So the addressee switches, probably. So the idea all throughout here is that you have purposes for the teacher and purposes for the student. Like, you might say the purposes for the student certainly are to know it, and then verse 3, to receive instruction. The purpose for the teacher may be more like verse 4, to give prudence to the simple. So both have goals that Proverbs is seeking to accomplish. But instruction it's sort of like a rainbow of teaching, right? The parents are sort of thinking, like, we've tried everything. It's kind of the idea. All sorts of different kinds of instruction we've used. And the purpose of all of that teaching is hopefully, at the end of the day, to produce understanding. Understanding is another one of the common theme words. Some of them are more themes just within this section, but understand is a more broad theme. And this is someone who can discern between competing ideas or competing alternatives. The options are on the table. And an understanding person, you would trust with the analysis and decision-making of those two options. It's one thing to walk someone through a decision. It's another thing to say, you make the decision. You look at the alternatives. You weigh them, you use skill and righteousness, and show that you possess understanding. So understanding is what Solomon prayed for back in 1 Kings 3. He prayed for a discerning heart so that he might understand between good and evil. Two options on the table, and he wants to know the right way to choose which one. Comparing concepts and making right judgments. In addition to kind of the ethical discernment, part of what we're talking about is just someone who gets it. Someone who's like, okay, they're tracking with you. They understand you. They're engaged. They're working because they're a diligent student who wants to see the mystery and they want to go unravel it with discernment. So they understand. They're thinking rightly, gathering what the sage intends, and they're engaging in meaningful meditation and assimilation of wisdom. And that assimilation is one of the keys for the student. You see that in verse 3. You see this reception. So it's not just knowing, like you have the aha moment, like I get it now, but now I want to make it a part of me. I'm going to live in that way. I want that to be a part of my DNA. I want to be one who fears the Lord. And so he receives it, this instruction of wisdom, which leads toward 3b, if someone has assimilated the truths of the wisdom corpus into their life, then it will produce righteousness, is that word for justice. It produces righteousness, judgment, and equity. These are virtues within the community that always bless the community. If you have a group of people who function around morality and right judgments and equity, then you have a very thriving and healthy community. You want to be fair. You want to be moral. You don't want to take bribes. You don't want to cut out someone just because of this or that. There's all of these reasons. So if every student gathers this, if every student is someone who's willing to hear and assimilate, then when they do that, it makes one individual and two individuals and three and four and five until, look, you have an entire family. You have the whole family of God-fearers who desire these same things. They're of one mind and one heart. In 4, 5, and then 7, you see introduced three of the four groups of people in the text. Those are the ones that are underlined. So one of the intentions of this book as a whole is to give prudence to the simple. Now, prudence is a less common word used in Proverbs. It's only three or four times, two of them, I think, here. Prudence is kind of clever or tricky. Sometimes it's a good thing, sometimes it's a bad thing. It's like you can see trouble on the horizon, and you sit down and you're like, how can I get around this? How can I maneuver things so that it all works out well for me? That's a very good thing. It's preparation, it's willingness to think ahead, all of those things. It's also sort of like a dodging trouble idea. Someone who's might be, a bit wily is maybe the idea. So you see danger incoming and you avoid it. So it's to give prudence the ability to avoid trouble to those who are simple. And that's the first category. Now, this is one of the things that will kind of table it for the weeks to come, the specifics of these four groups of people. But as an introduction, the simple person is the one that has not yet committed to the ways of God, still thinking, kind of on the fence. He wants to keep options open, ears open. I'm willing to hear various voices. And he's poised, balancing, not the most informed, but maybe thinks they are, and not all in. So, and wisdom will call primarily to that person because wisdom wants a commitment. So there's the simple person. He's saying, this is for them. This is for those who are younger. Normally that would be a younger person. In our society, probably the older teenager, sort of this idea. The older teen is going to now avoid trouble. And the parents would say, that would be wonderful. Right? There's the father to the son. And then he says, to the young man, knowledge and discretion. The young man's not another common category in Proverbs, but it's describing really a range, I think an age range for the simple, which is the Hebrew word peti. It's an age range from like very little, from the youngest, up to probably like 25-ish. It's like up to maybe you could stretch it to be an independent man getting there, like right there. Anywhere in there, they're like decision-making, learning, a lot of decisions made for them early, and then later on they're beginning to make more of them. There's kind of that transition. And so he's calling for them, for the young people. The young people are the primary audience of Proverbs because you're the ones that could get ahead of the ball. Like if a 70-year-old says, I want to crack open Proverbs and say, okay, I'm willing to listen. You say, good, that's wonderful, but you're 70. You have a lot of experiences. You've learned a lot of these things. You're going to be able to say, check, check, check. I have a story for that. I have a story for that. I have a story for that. The 15-year-old doesn't have stories for all these things. They have opinions about all these things, but they don't have stories for all these things. And so for them to be able to hear the stories of the wise, of the ones informed by Yahweh, and to say, even if I don't totally see it, I'm in. I'll trust it. That leads to a life that is blessed along the way. Most people who are older, if you're listening to them talk, they would say, yep, I learned this the hard way. I learned this by experience. And what they're really saying is, I didn't embrace wisdom early. I learned it. It was the school of hard knocks. So in some way, Proverbs is, could function to avoid some of the school of hard knocks. But it's not just for the young. It's also for the old. Verse 5. There's a wise man here. There's a wise man in the text. And what is he doing? He's hearing and what? A wise man is increasing. A wise man is Yosef. He's growing. He's being added to. Okay. Lesson learned. So it's not just grandpa saying, now let me teach you a thing or two, son, because I know. Now there's things you know, but you're saying, come along the path with me. Walk with me. Hold my hand. I've been there and I'm going there. There's a measure of wisdom that has continued to be added to and increased all along the way. You haven't, the oldest and wisest in here, has not mastered wisdom, is not there. Right? If Solomon wasn't there, nobody's there, So there's this whole community idea, from the babies who are completely, they have all the decisions made for them and they know nothing, to the older people who make all their own decisions and they know everything. Wisdom is for you. The skill of righteous living is for you. And it helps to then, verse 6, we talked about this a little bit with Michal, but to then get it, to get some of the mystery. So that when, like in the New Testament, when Jesus teaches a parable, and everyone's like, wait, what? And they all are confused, and they go away thinking, and they go away considering. And then maybe he has a follow-up conversation with the disciples, and he says, you want to kind of know a little more about that? You want to know what I mean? Here, let me teach you again. That's kind of the idea. So you have a community from the youngest to the oldest of people who are intending, whose goal, as stated by Proverbs, is to get it, to capture it, to understand it, to be able to have two options on the table and to know, to have confidence. That's what this is talking about, the mashal, and then kind of the enigma, some of the mystery, to be able to see through some of the mystery, to turn the light on in the darkness, to maybe blow some of the smoke away from a hard situation. The words of the wise and their riddles. Keep in mind, just as in the back of your mind, the intention of Proverbs is not to confuse you. The intention of Proverbs is not to trick you and like, ah, you missed it because you're dumb. Like, that's not what he's saying. Like, are you weren't listening. His intention is to instruct so that all these things take place. Just know that it means you have to work. And then he leads towards verse 7, which we're going to table for next week. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. There's the third of four people. So the simple, the wise, the fools. The fourth one is the mocker or the scorner. And we'll see them come up when we return to chapter 1. So, in summary, there exists a body of inspired literature that's collected by the sages, and its intention is to instruct any who will hear and fear the Lord. The call is for each generation, every new generation, which means it's constantly fresh and new, to inherit wisdom without demanding that they test it extensively before doing so. Wisdom will flow out of those who possess it and into those who will receive it. This essential and generational exchange blesses each participant, and it brings unity and peace to the family of faith as the young ones commit their lives to the ways of Yahweh. So why do we need this book? Why are we preaching through this book? Why are we studying it? Because if you desire to live well in God's world, then you need Proverbs. That's why it's here. That is its function in the canon. It instructs us in the righteous precepts ingrained in Yahweh's creation, and it forms us as we commit to the pursuit of becoming humans skilled in ethical excellence and moral majesty. So the individual at work can navigate being a Christian employee who will not compromise their morals, but will work diligently for their company. The individual in class can now sort of dance their way with discernment through the minefield of secular instruction, receiving valuable information with humility, without folding to the pressure of godlessness. The parent obtains a blueprint for instruction and education and formation, which is grounded in the eternal truth of Yahweh, and they then gather a variety of resources to engage along the way. The young person could walk skillfully through years of decision-making before they have too much experience, but with faithfulness to their maker, though the voices of the world will appeal to and proposition them, hoping to gain their souls. So the quiet will learn when to speak, and the speakers will learn when to be quiet, so that the frugal will learn when to open their purse, and those who live with their purse open might learn frugality. So the trudgers could pick up the pace, and the rushers may learn when to trudge. The lazy will learn to work hard, and the hard workers will learn to rest, right? There's something about every moment that requires skill in righteousness, and so there's no moment of life untouched by Proverbs. If you're alive in God's world, then you need this book. One note, and then we're done. Foundationally, Proverbs is oriented around law. It sounds very Deuteronomy when you say, okay, live wisely and experience full blessing. Live with folly, experience curse. Right? We've seen that in the law and in Israel's agreement to God. As believers, as Christians, we know that we are kind of personally unable to engage in true obedience, in full obedience. We know that from our past, right? In our old lives, we learned that. Even when we did good and maybe wise things, we know that we were characterized by folly and rebellion, perhaps even scorners. And then we also know that in our new lives in Christ, we still play the fool at times, probably more often than we'd want to admit. We play like some of these other characters that experience cursing. So as such, based on our old life and even some of our current practice, we deserve cursing rather than blessing. We know that that's true. So Proverbs does point forward. It does anticipate and quietly yearns for a human fully skilled in morality. So it does look to Christ, one who is truly righteous. However, as we think through the book, and we'll talk about that theme as we walk through, that our inability to do this and Christ's ability to do it. Not something on the table. It's also true, though, that if you've been united with Christ and you're reborn and you have this newness of nature and are, again, united in his life, then indeed you have been given this everlasting water to drink and you are drinking from this well of Jesus. So you are by nature righteous. You are by nature, well, skilled and righteous, I suppose, is slightly different. But you're on the path of wisdom. That's who we are. And so Jesus has draped his perfect morality and his righteousness upon us. So as we consider living with skill, we're really talking about living in the skill of Christ. So we should live with great rejoicing because of the wonders that he has done. Walking in wisdom is for you, and it is before you. So with full hearts, let's fix our eyes on the grace of God in Christ Jesus. And let's look at Proverbs and learn to walk in his world in his way. And as we do that, I believe that he will bless this family, this community of faith, with unity around the perfectly wise one, the righteous Son, Jesus our Savior.